Well, today we are going to look at a couple things, and sometimes when I'm sharing, I think, man, it's so obvious, but then I remind myself, sometimes I need to be reminded of the obvious, such as, you know, God has created us as people, human beings, with the capacity and the need to remember. See, memory is a critical part of comprehension and learning. It's essential for physical, mental, spiritual growth. It's vital for healthy relationships, for fulfilling roles and responsibilities, and for enduring through hardships. And we don't really think about memory. A lot of times as you get older, you think about what you can't remember. Well, you don't actually think about it. You just remember that you can't remember the details because you can't join the conversation, whatever. But think about some of those basic things. Kids, if you have a good memory, it's going to help you. Right? If you're told to do chores and you remember to do your chores, life is good. You don't, guess what? There's starting to be challenged. Memory is one of those things we can just kind of take for granted. There's many different types of memory. I looked at a few and I'm like, the people that study this need to get a life. There's just other things to do. There's just like all these different things. And there's implicit memory. There's procedural memory. There's explicit memory, declarative memory, semantic memory, episodic memory, which means it's related to an episode. And there's all these different things. And I want to present to you something that I think is maybe a street level way to describe an important part of memory: value-based memory. See, I've noticed that those who have a healthy expression of love and a better balance in life, they also have a good value-based memory. Well, what is a value-based memory? Well, I would describe it in these ways. It's where you retain certain memories based on a value that you have. A value-based memory works through emotions in hardships, and it holds on to what you value. And here's an example. Moms work through the pain of childbirth by loving their newborn child. What if every time mom held that child, she remembered, "You hurt me so much. I am having a hard time sharing food with you right now. You are just..." See, it's just so simplistic, but it's so essential. It's value-based. You value that person, and you learn to... There is suffering, there is pain, there's hardship in life. And we are a society that's set on avoiding that. We have prescriptions, we have recommendations, we have all these things to avoid pain. And you will not grow in relationships without pain. I wish I could say, no, it's okay. You know, just, it's not... Pain is a part of life. It's the reality of when death entered this world, when humanity rebelled against its creator, and death entered this world. And so value-based is where, as I've said, a mom values the joy before her and moves away from the pain that was so recent to her. Friends work through differences when they value one another. Family works through adversity when they value one another. Family is a funny thing. Maybe it's not always funny, but, you know, it is a funny thing because you think about siblings. My older brother, he's just a year older than me. My sister was 2 years older. So my mom, by the time she's 20, she has 3 kids. Okay, my younger brother comes along 5 years later. He doesn't count because he got spoiled because he come along later. So anyway, we'll talk about the first 3. Just kidding. I'm not really kidding. It's true. So anyway, here's the 3 of us as siblings. We did everything together. We did everything. John, my older brother, you know what we called each other when we were younger? Brother. It just made sense. He's not his sister. So it was just brother. Hey, brother, you want to go do this? Hey, brother. It wasn't because it was cool. Hey, bro, you want to go do something? No, it was just brother. We just did everything together. I mean, we got in trouble together. We lied together. We tried to get out of trouble together. We just did life together. But what's interesting, that's the funny thing about family. When you have this sibling commonality because of the family dynamic, you don't notice how different you are. But when you go from childhood, that commonality, into adulthood, that's where you discover your many differences. Agreed? That's when the fights get a little more vicious for guys. Maybe, well, I've seen some cat fights with some girls that are rare. So it gets really more intense. So it's like when your family member, when you start acknowledging their differences, even appreciating one another more, you do that because you value them as a person. Does that make sense in all of this? How we have to actually assert that. We have to establish that. And we have to fight for that. Because we have to recognize, man, there's that when you get older and you start seeing the difference, I think we could do a show of hands. We don't need to. But we'd see how many people, they start distancing. And as a pastor, I've noticed something else. You know what brings them back around? Sadly, funerals, memorials. When they're standing off, or they come in at different times, and an outside service, one's over here and one's over here, and they're stink-eyeing each other. And then they soften. And then they can't remember why they weren't talking in the first place. And sometimes, it's ironic, it's funerals and weddings that tend to bring about the sense of value base. It's easy to say we're family-oriented. It's harder to be family-based, family-oriented. And so when we recognize that, when we see these things in our lives and start, you know, just kind of being aware that, you know, there's differences. There's things that we have to recognize and respect and realize. Value-based memory works through pain and disagreement and hardship. Value-based memory is modeled by Jesus, because we're told in Hebrews, Jesus, the author and finisher, which means the completer of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. There was a value to this. He understood, not in a memory sense, but an awareness sense, he was going to the cross, and it was going to be brutal. It was going to be physically painful. But he did it for what reason, according to that? He, for the joy that was set before him, understanding the pain and the suffering was going to accomplish his purpose. And he realized, this is what I'm going to do it. I'm going to go through that. The joy that was set before him. He went through the pain because he valued you and me. Value-based memory is selective memory. Choosing to hold tight to what complements and encourages and builds up another. See, some of us struggle because we have mathematical memory, statistical memory, the scales. When you recognize what someone's done beneficial, you're like, oh yeah, but then you immediately shift over here. Like, yeah, but I also remember what else they did. No, value-based memory is selective memory. And if you want a personal study of that, study Hebrews 11. When God talks about the men and women of faith, and the instruments that he revealed truth to. And if you study them by name, use it as a topical guideline in Hebrews 11, and you walk through that list and you go to the Old Testament and you read everything you can find about them, you're going to raise your hand and you go, God, you forgot a few key points. This Abraham guy, the father of our faith, could we talk about that? Because his wife, Sarah, has an issue with him kind of ditching her a couple of times. You know what I'm saying? Because see, God sees things differently. And he teaches us to be able to see with this sense of, a memory and a realization because it's value-based. I've noticed that people that hold on to hurts and focus on their own experience are very lonely people. And they're very sad people. And they're very discouraged people. But people who choose, like, I'm going to look at things differently. And I'm talking about people who have been brutally wounded and terribly treated. But when they choose to make this their focus, I'm going to embrace this. I'm going to hold on to this. Obviously, I'm going to move through this a little quicker. There's just some things that are other factors that influence our memory. I'm talking about conscious memory, making choices. Some memories are embedded. They're irremovable. They're at times unavoidable. They're the memories that are often horrible things that people have done one to another. They awaken you in the night. They rob you of your joy. You want so bad to remove them, but they just keep coming back. God, in his mercy, in that relationship he's offered to you, he teaches us how to manage those memories as we learn to hand them over to him, the hardships and realities. But back to value-based. Obviously, there's some issues we struggle with. Recall. Anybody struggle with recall? It's not that you don't remember. It's you can't find the file. And then, you know, it takes a little, you know, stimulation, a little trigger, and then, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. See, I think it's important that we choose, even as this weekend would imply, Memorial Weekend, that we choose to revisit our memories. It's like an old photo album. When the one who experienced a photo revisits the album, the memories are uncovered and brought back to life. It's part of the reason it's so painful for you to watch somebody else's home movies or go through their photo album. You ever done that? You ever been taken through that misery? Where they want to show, oh, this was when we did this, and this is when we did this, and you're like, I have no idea who that weird-looking person is. Because you weren't there. But for someone else, they can't stop talking about the little Polaroid or the picture because it's their life experience, and they revisit this photo. Oh, man, and that's when Grandma did this. And you're like, move on. We've got 94 pages in this album. Move along. You weren't there. It doesn't register to you, but to them. You see what I'm saying? Because I think we're losing some of that. I think a fast-paced digital society has to change and bring in new disciplines to gather and hold and to retain life stories and those things that are so important. We have to revisit those things. So you think about it. Conversations help to remember. Campfire stories, family gatherings, monuments. They remind us. Last year, we spent some time up at a family, you know, get-together, family camp out. And to be there and to watch our grandchildren just like in awe soak up these campfire stories. And it was just my brother and I and my dad and some other. We're just sharing life stories. And Joe, oh, you remember when? Of course, you know, we have to kind of choose our memories, of course. But, you know, and they're like, the kids are like, and they're like, they're in awe. They're, the whole thing, is just, it's to me, it's a powerful experience when we revisit those. And, you know, you've been there in the gatherings, in the conversations. And so the passage today is about remembering what God has done. Already we're going to Joshua chapter 4 with the remaining 3 minutes we have today. Just kidding. Joshua chapter 4. I wanted to set the stage so clearly because I know some people are going through a lot of adversity and a lot of difficulty, and these things are not easily dealt with, but choose your memories and cherish love. That's what I want to encourage you. Joshua chapter 4, the base, there's a lot of parallels for our time, our country, and a lot of things. You know, Moses has led the nation. Moses has passed away. Joshua is now the one to take the baton and lead the people and to shepherd the people. And Joshua is going to be, he's a powerful figure, an amazing example of godliness. But he's been given instruction now, and it's time to move from one side of the River Jordan, a natural barrier. It's time for this nation to move. A couple million people are going to relocate into what's known as the Promised Land on the other side. And Joshua is given instruction, and he's the one to take this lead. And we pick up in verse 19 of chapter 4 as they've crossed the River Jordan, and he's going to give some instruction for themselves as well as for the future. In verse 19, the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east side of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up in Gilgal. Then he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over, that all the people of the earth may know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So it's a great story. I mean, it's a kind of a summary there at the end of the chapter. Well, the instruction was given that there was 12 men who were supposed to pick up a stone. And I'm going to say a big one. It wasn't a little pebble. It was like something to represent your tribe. And they actually did two things. They stacked a bunch of rocks, big stones, in the middle of the Jordan. So There's the waters held back. They made this monument in the middle of the Jordan River, which is kind of more of a creek by our measure. But anyway, they stack it there. And then they took another stone, and they carried that on up to Gilgal, where they would encamp, which will be their base for many days, many months, actually, as they move into the promised land. And they built these monuments there. One stone to represent each tribe of the nation Israel. And we see now they've got this set, and then he gives us some insight into why it was to take place. Let's jump into application. Let's be practical. Let's dig in. Let's see what it has to do with us. It's history, but there's a lot to it. Verse 19, I would draw your emphasis to remember what he has done. The people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day in the first month and camped in Gilgal on the other side. Remember what he has done. See, God did a work in their lives. Do you think they got tired of waiting on the other side? Yes. Do you think there's a point they might have been impatient? Yes. Do you think there's some times you're like, okay, when's this next step going to take place? We've been hanging tight and hanging loose, and man, what's going to happen? But Joshua is reminding them, you know, say, listen, let's not forget what God has done. The word tells us here, the people came up, they moved, they took the next step. Remember what he has done. Now, I would actually pick that a little further and say, be a part of what he's doing. Remember what he's done and be a part of what he's doing. Some people want to sit on the other side. A couple tribes actually did, half tribe. I would suggest to you, it's much better to go where God would lead you than to sit back looking back at what he's done in the past. Remember what he has done. Now, this is personal. I can't give you the specifics and the details for your life, but I'm confident there are things you can look back and go, God has done that. God took care of that. God helped me. You may have a hard time articulating that, putting that to words for someone else, kind of like the photo album when you're trying to explain something, because someone else didn't experience it. They would have doubt or wonder, and maybe they may say, well, that happens to a lot of people. But you have the knowledge of what God has done. Those people knew that God had brought them to that side of the river and took them across. Remember what God has done, we see in verse 19. They were ready to move. Verse 20, they took those 12 stones, they took them out of the Jordan, and Joshua set up. We know from the context of just what we've read, build for the benefit of others. Build for the benefit of others. It's not just about me, my personal journey with Jesus. It's not just about me and my perception about God and God's hand. They're doing something here that's going to be handed off. It's for the generations to come. Now, of course, people say, well, gosh, if we're going to get raptured out of here next weekend, you know, why am I building anything? Well, you know, the reality is some people will still be here. The reality is this building for the benefit of others is not just chronological. In other words, it's not saying, well, 6 months down the road or 10 years, I want them to inherit this, or 50 years, this will take place. We inherited this from this family member who then to the grandparent and then to the parent. Those are wonderful things. Those are biblical things. But when I'm talking about, you know, building for the benefit of others, this sweat was extended. You know, I'm sure those stones were big, and I'm sure it wasn't just 20 feet up the bank and build it there. There was some distance involved. There was some sweat. There was some labor. There was some strain involved, and it was for the benefit of someone else, knowing that they needed to know what God had already done. That's why you and I have a command, a requirement, a relational responsibility to share the truths of the gospel with the next generation, and we're building for the benefit of others. We also see in verse 21 and 22, we're to share what God has done in your life. As we see that he spoke to the children. You know, when your kids come to their fathers in time to come saying, what are these stones? Share what God has done in your life. It's good for you because it helps remind you of his faithfulness, okay? How many of you, I don't need to do a show of hands, so we'll phrase it different. Some people like to do prayer journals or, you know, just a journal of their relationship with God. And I encourage that. However it works for you to keep a reminder, a record, if you would, of God's faithfulness. That when you review that, often in a time of difficulty and trial, you can see. Now, I've kept a prayer journal off and on over the years. I'm not real diligent in entries. But it was interesting. I reviewed one from a couple decades ago. And I only made maybe 2, 3, 5 entries a year. But over about a 7-year period, there's quite a few entries that are short. They're a paragraph. They're not for me to read to people. They're just a thought and a compliment and an acknowledgement before God. But you know what happened? Reading those reminded me of God's faithfulness. It helped me to personalize and bring back, because my mind is just, there's just too many other things that cause question and doubt. So it's good for you to share what God has done in your life. It reminds you of his faithfulness. It's good for the listener and encourages them to hear what God has done. You know, in your world, in our lives individually, there are people longing to see the works of God. They're done with religion. They've heard enough of the hypocritical conversation. They've seen the facade, that false front that presents itself as good and is contrary in lifestyle and work and other places. They're done with it. They always have been done with it. What they want to see, what they want to hear is what God has done. They want to see a living testimony of a transformed life. They want to see that life before them. They want to know the truth, and they don't need all the answers. They'll have a lot of questions, but they're not wanting all the answers. They want reality. They want a life that is living and vibrant, and there's a evidence of the presence of God somehow that they can confirm, because they too want the truths of Scripture. And so it's good for the listener to be able to share what God has done. You know, I want to emphasize in verse 21 and 22, you know, he spoke to the children of Israel. So Joshua is speaking. When your children ask their fathers, when they ask their fathers in time to come, what's all this, what's with these stones? I believe it's very important that we keep this in our mind as men. Men need to show up, step up, and speak up. Show up means you're there, not just delegating it to the spouse. You show up, you step up. They're to take the role, to fulfill the responsibility, and to speak up. To be able to voice to their children what God has done. Be a voice for God with your kids. Don't try to be the pastor. Don't try to be the Sunday school teacher. Be the loving dad who loves the Lord. And let that be evidence to them. So it's just real straight up. Show up, step up, and speak up. When possible, join together with your wife and prepare your children well. Will they want to hear it? Maybe. Maybe not. You know, will they follow what you teach them? Maybe. Maybe not. See, will you have done your part to best prepare them? That's our part. That's our part. I think back how it's a struggle to teach spiritual truths, because there's just a lot in our mind as men, and it's not a gender-exclusive thing. But I also think, when I was teaching my kids about finances, I knew that they might not follow it, but I knew they needed to know it. And they might not put money away. They might spend more than they've had, but I wanted to prepare them. So I didn't hesitate to teach that simple truth to them in regards to truthfulness or honesty. I wasn't looking at it truthfully. I wasn't taking a spiritual angle. It made them better kids, better people, to be honest and truthful. And so I wanted to teach them that, and I made it an emphasis. And it was the thing we said. Listen, I would actually revoke discipline on occasions if they did this one thing. Listen, I'm not going to go through this he said, she said thing. I'm going to ask you right now, tell me the truth. And they knew if they told the truth, at times there would be less penalty. Because I want them to value truth. Now, would I say, you know what, they're probably not going to follow it anyway. I'm not going to teach it. No. I want them to know when they're on their own and they're doing their deal, I want to know that I prepared them as best I could. And then when they moved out, I had to start part two. Did you hear that? I had to start part two. Part one was easy. I could make them go to their room, and then I could invade their space and talk to them. I had control. Part two is horrible. Part two, they come and go. They can do what they want. They can say what they want to say. And they'll just, you know, they could. You don't have to get into it. Many of you know what I'm talking about. But yet I still have that responsibility, my part, to do a refresher course, to be patient and kind, to be understanding and empathetic, to be loving and not through hard times, because I still want them to get it. Do you see the spiritual truth? I believe sometimes men struggle because they're not sure what to say. Please, just convey what you know to be true. Convey about God's faithfulness. Just convey it. Will they accept it? Maybe. Maybe not. Don't worry about that. You convey with love and kindness the truth of God, then you're going to see a powerful thing take place, which leads us to the next part, verse 23, believe what God has done. It's hard to convey what I haven't settled. It's hard to be confident in something that I have a cloud about. And so it's so important that I'm willing to believe what God has done. Notice in verse 23, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until we crossed over, as the Lord had your God did to the Red Sea. See, the kids, the generation that's coming in, some of them were under the age of 20. They were just kids when they left Egypt, when the Red Sea was parted. Some of them were born in the wandering stages, you know, in that time in the wilderness. And so what's being conveyed here is some of them that will convey to their children, they didn't experience the Red Sea, but they believed the story. Not because it was a story, because it was history, because it really happened. Every generation, because of this spiritual battle I referenced to begin with, every generation tries to rewrite history. They want to change it to fit what they currently believe. So they want to remove certain figures or retitle that person to fit what they want to believe. But get this, you can't change history. It already happened. You can tilt your bias, you can present your opinion, but you can't change history. God parted the Red Sea. I wasn't there. I have seen Charlton Heston try to put a handle on it, put a booming voice to it. I've seen some pretty fascinating things. My imagination does better. To imagine the sea parted, the fear of crossing, to realize what it would be like to have this wall of water to your left and to your right, and you're passing through on dry ground and you're in a hurry. And the further you get, the closer you get to the other side, and there's a hope, the more the enemy seems to catch up with you. And to get there, oh, wow. See, the fathers were to convey that, even though they didn't personally live through it, because it was truth, because it happened. And so I want to encourage you, believe what God has done, history, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea. See, I think this helps because when we allow his story to be our history, it helps us personally. Here's what happens. It fosters humility, especially in all of us, but I think of men. It fosters humility. It's hard to take credit when you remember your prayers. Have you ever realized that? Let's just hit rewind for some of you. Remember that prayer? Remember that scenario? Maybe your marriage was falling apart. Maybe life was just in a bad spot. And you had that really powerful, deep King James prayer that went like this. Oh, God. That's all you said. That's all you said. You had no words to hook to it. You had no hope. You had nothing. Oh, God, in the tears, and then your anger, and I don't know what to do. And God came through. And then it starts changing and things happen. Oh, it's just because I grabbed myself by my bootstraps and straightened myself up. There's no such thing as a self-made man. Self-made man is a not born again man. A self-made man is headed for hell. There's no such thing as a self-made man. And so when we get that, when we realize, man, God intervened in the business or the marriage or with the children, it's hard to take credit. Many a successful person, and I say successful, I want to use the biblical definition for that. Many a successful person has been carried by the prayers of a grandma or a grandpa or an uncle who faithfully prayed them through. It's hard to pat yourself on the back when you know someone else carried you through. It's hard to say, oh, look at what I've done. You, you know, and then the grandparents like, oh man, I got to get back to prayer. This guy's really out there. It's like, so realize that. Believe what God has done. It helps us to reset. It helps us to be refreshed. It helps us to recognize. So I'm going to do a quick review. Remember what he has done. Build for the benefit of others. Share what God has done in your life. These are important because they're personal monuments. They're the rocks of remembrance. They're the stones in the middle of the Jordan on the other side. I think of my own memorials real quickly. My wife, Kim, who came to faith a year before I did, and patiently endured and prayed and was hoping and praying that her husband would respond to the forgiveness God offered. And I see how she went through that. That was like a couple weeks ago. Like 38 years ago. Well, I guess it was less than that. It was 35-ish, 6, I don't know. 3 decades plus a few other numbers. So, long time ago. But it's so important to me because I see her, what she did and how she endured that. I see my mom. Many of you, quite a few of you, know the story about my mom. My mom was the first one I got to baptize as a pastor here in Mountain Home. She had come to Christ late in life after her and dad had divorced. And she had an encounter with God in such a way that it was real and vibrant. And I see how Kim's faithfulness and my response to the gospel affected someone else in our life. And I look and see, I remember the tank outside the other building and all the other details I could share at another point, and baptizing my mom and the tears of those in the audience who've been praying for her for weeks, months, and to see the response to the gospel, to see that unfold. I think of my dad, who I've shared about recently, who came to Christ just a couple years ago. In a genuine conversion, a realization of the truth of the gospel, and a personal conviction, a commitment, a response to that invitation, and a life that's currently changing. As he's nearing departure, I'm sure he is a changed man. I think of Uncle Warren. You know, I have his card here. This is Mom's a reminder for her when she got to go home. This is my Uncle Warren. This is my dad's brother. And he was the only Christian in the family that I knew. As a young Christian, he welcomed me in. And he started teaching me things that he didn't know how to articulate real well. But he loved me. And he impacted my life. And he affected you because I'm here speaking and sharing because of his impact in my life. I think of our children and the hardships and the difficulties they've went through. I think about just, you know, their reflection and their compliment to Kim or to myself and the things that they have went through and recognizing God's presence in their lives. I think of this church. For 20 plus years now, we've been gathering as a group. And I think of the lives that were changed. I think of Carlos Rodriguez, and I could go through this list of people who were changed. These are memorial stones to me. These are lives that were transformed by the living God. And these are lives that have been impacted for eternity, and they're impacting other people. And so I have to hit pause. I like being busy. I don't rest well, my wife says. I had my gallbladder removed last Monday. I might have overdid it the rest of the week a little bit, maybe. Thanks for your prayers in that regard. So, by the way, I feel a lot better. But I have to choose my memories. I have to stop long enough to say, this is important to me. I won't arrive at where I want to be unless I make decisions to get there. And I have to repent. I have to humble myself before people. I have to acknowledge my faults at times to get to where I want to go, because I really believe it's important. And so let me finish up with verse 24. When we share what God has done, when you speak of his faithfulness, when we direct people to God, we are giving them the knowledge they need to make a decision. Verse 24 says that the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever. You're preparing people. You're giving them the information because of your life story. How many of you like to make critical decisions with insufficient information? That would be nobody. Critical, business related or anything. Critical. I'm not talking about... Critical decisions, But they say, well, we can't tell you everything until after you decide, and then we'll let you know whether you've passed or failed. You'd be like, shut up. I'm not making that. No. We don't want to make those decisions without sufficient information. Your life is a declaration of the presence of God and the power of God. And you provide people information and knowledge to make a decision concerning Jesus Christ. And so keep that in mind. You know, it says that the people would know the hand of the Lord. The hand of the Lord. What a picture. What a presentation. What an analogy, so to speak. Here is this hand of the Lord. When I think of the hand of the Lord, I think of Jesus. I think of his hand extended to the sick and to the hurting, to those who have lost hope. Here's a hand of acceptance. His hand extended to the tired and the weary. When he said, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. You got to believe he wasn't doing this. You got to know that. You got to know when he said, come to me, all you who are tired and worn out by the ways of this world, come to me. For my yoke, my burden is different. It's lighter. It's easier. It's what you're made for. And he extends that. When I think of the hand of the Lord, I think of his provision looking back in my life. I think of his protection. I think of his comfort. Hopefully you too think of his companionship. Many people in this room are lonely people. There's loved ones near you and people close by, but you're lonely. But you know what God said to you? And you have a hard time accepting it? I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will always be there with you. And so we struggle sometimes. I think of his hand, his companionship. He never leaves me. When I think of his hand, I can't help but think of the cross. His hand providing for you and for me. His hand, weak and defeated, nailed to a cross, lifeless and left in a tomb. All seems lost. It's over. It's a failure. It didn't work. But then his hand is open wide in victory. The report comes of his resurrection. The realization, and he would show the side and his hands to you, his follower. Say, oh no, blessed are you when you believe. His hand extended wide in victory. His hand extended to whoever would believe in him. That's what I think of when I think of the hand of the Lord.